So I want to welcome James to the show and Robert Wallace, our community development director. James, welcome.
Thank you, Greg. Hello. And hi, Robert. How are you today?
I'm doing great, James. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
So, Robert, I want to get back to you, James, because you're one of our normies. You're one of our, I don't want to use that in a denigrating term at all. You're one of our quote unquote ordinary people, ordinary readers, listeners who've stepped up and gotten more involved. And I want to get into that story. But before I do that, I want to go to Robert because we're doing a fundraiser. We're doing a matching grant, a $1,200 matching grant. And Robert is the guy who put up the money for the matching grant. So folks, every dollar you send in today, you're going to be picking Robert's pocket for the same amount, up to $1,200. $1,200 is our 12th anniversary. So anyway, Robert, thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it. What's the story behind this matching grant?
I'll go to 1,500. I'll go to at least 1,500 if we can get up there too.
So. Oh, okay. Well, that is fantastic.
It's the 12-year anniversary, of course, so we have the 1,200. But don't let that hold you back.
Okay. Well, folks, you heard it. So get your super chats in and pick this gentleman's pocket. So Robert, where did all this money come from? There's a story behind that.
There's a story, and I did send an email out to our supporters. So there was the Kentucky Derby, and I was just happened to be watching that kind of randomly when it occurred. And there's this wonderful horse that won. It was an 80-1 odd horse, Rich Strike, that won. And that story just, it really touched me because, of course, for the obvious reasons, but it was also the people that trained the horse. They were like relatives that I have. They're working class, sort of soul of the earth type Americans, but they're also just really high quality people at the same time. And so it was a really beautiful story. I recommend people to look into that. They did press conferences afterwards and interviews, sort of the typification of a feel good story. But anyways, my mom and I were both moved by that story. So it was Mother's Day when it happened. And I said, opportunity here. I'm going to buy two tickets to the Preakness and take my mom. And we had really, really nice seats, apron box seats right next to the finish line, right up next to the track. So it was a special experience with my mom and I. And I made, I had done some research, you know, the history major doing research, and I had done a research on the horses. And I bet a box trifecta. You had early voting, epicenter, and creative minister. I actually picked the exact order. It's really unfortunate that I didn't make that bet because I think I would have won like $15,000 or $20,000. But the box trifecta is when you pick the top three, not in any particular order. So I did win that bet, and the return was nice. So that's why I'm able to do the matching grant. But, you know, it's a fun story, but it's also, I will be contributing significantly more by the end of the year, and I'll be contributing even significantly more next year because I need to walk it like I talk it. I'm in this thing, but I'm in this thing because I know it is the most viable path forward towards empowering white identity. That's why I'm doing this. And our biggest problem is a lack of resources, a lack of wealth, period. That's why I joined this, because it is the problem that we have. Number one, no contest. And that's why I came here. Fortunately, I had really good training doing this type of work in my previous life. And but yes, it's we can talk about that a little bit more in a second, Greg. But we have to come to terms with the reality of the problem. We need to popularize white identity politics before we can empower white identity, before we can influence politics. And the only way we are going to be able to do that is through becoming very much wealthier than we are. Because Greg Cyan and I, we know how to overcome the censorship blockade. We know how to do it. We understand the methods. I'm not going to reveal the methodology on a public podcast, but we know how to do it. The issue is we don't have the wealth to do it. We talked about this. I talked about this with Greg Hood the other night on the AmRent podcast, Greg. We can't coddle our supporters. We can't coddle white nationals. You deserve much better than that. We need to be blunt and objective about the issues that we have. These are very intelligent, honorable people. We're not going to coddle you. We're going to tell you exactly what we need done, what we need everybody to do in order to accomplish the goals we all share.
You know, there's a commentator, frequent commentator at Countercurrents, Lord Shang. He's been having some health issues. We're worried about him. I hope to see him commenting more again soon. But anyway, he made a comment months ago, basically. He said, you know, we really need to be able to motivate people to die for the cause. And I wrote back and I think that, yeah, there are certain things that everybody should know if they're worth dying for, you know, what, how far you're going to go for the most important things. However, we don't have to go quite that far. I don't have to motivate people. I can motivate people to do a lot for the cause, not by getting them to give away with their lives, but simply by paying them a competitive salary. you know, we can get professional people with excellent experience and training, academic credentials, and a lot of social capital. These people are in our movement. They're sympathetic to our cause. We can get them actually working full time if we just have the capital to do it, if we have the money. And so it was late last year that I started thinking about doing this, creating a more professional back office for Countercurrents. I started being a little more ambitious. I took some lessons from you in donor development, and I went out and started asking for large amounts of money, and people started pledging it. And I said, okay, there's a deep truth here. The more you ask, the more you can get. And so anyway, we brought you in at the beginning of the year, and you've been working with us to basically increase our ability to get the word out. And you've also been writing and podcasting and so forth. So you're one of the fruits of our becoming much more ambitious and professional. And it's the donors out there who make that possible. And folks, if you want to help out today, your money goes even further.
Could I just interject there for a second, Greg? So, you know, I'm not a fundraiser, okay? I'm a leader. I'm a white advocate. I'm someone who is as idealistic about our cause as anyone else in this movement. People don't understand that in the world of politics, in the world of power politics in the United States, all of these people you see as leaders, they spend at least 75% of their time on philanthropy. But that's concealed because the powers that be don't really want you to understand how that works. And the last thing I'll say is a reference to my Bia Medici article. I recommend people because it's a good way of framing this, understanding this differently and sort of breaking down some of the stigmas that are there, is that all of us would like to be soldiers on a battlefield, or we'd like to be a, you know, a Roman emperor or something like that. There's a kind of like LARPy thing where, you know, for example, I have Aeneas as my avatar, this type of thing. Of course, we all have that romantic, heroic vision about how we can support the cause. But what really needs to be done is this. This is what needs to be done. As far as the Medici article is concerned, the Medici comparison is good because the state, the public sector, was not sponsoring projects that were going to cause cultural renewal that Europe needed, that our people needed at that time. It was coming from, it needed to come from private sources. And that's a situation we're in today. You know, the goal is to have our own state. We don't have to do fundraising when we have our own state. But this is the situation we're in now. It's not going to change anytime soon. It's only going to change when we have our own state. So we just have to understand philanthropy. We have to understand philanthropy in of itself. We have to understand that this is the main thing that we have to focus on. As far as people who aren't working directly in our movement, this is the main thing you have to be focused on. So whatever it is that you do for a living, you're working. You are working for your people. That's the way to look at that. You're working for your family and you're working for your people. All of us are working for our people together, even if you're not directly employed by Countercurrents. So thank you, Greg.
Yeah, well, that is great. I want to bring in James now. And can you tell us about yourself? How did you get to be a reader? And then how did you take the step into getting more involved? Because I think this is an important story.
Sure. Yes. Well, I hadn't heard of Countercurrents prior to about 2016. I had for years, I mean, most of my adult life and even teen years, I was unapologetic about being white, but I considered myself just a person who could get along with everybody, provided we believed the same things. And about 2015, my family and I decided to relocate from where we were because of what we determined to be a dead-end street. Apropos of race relations, you know, it was right around the time, it was 2015 or 14, right around the time of the Michael Brown verdict. And where we were at the time, there were people following that verdict, just given free rein to maraud, go a clubbing everyone in the streets and, you know, punch people through their car windows and whatnot. And my wife and I were watching this and on the news and decided, you know, this, there's nothing for us here. We've got to go somewhere else, you know, for the particular reasons that where we were just looked like it had no future, at least for us. And so we regrouped, relocated, and it was really an impetus for me to start thinking about figuring out, not just in a haphazard way, but what do I really believe? And because no one seems to be neutral here, everybody, even the ones who are neutral, are swept up in a wave of just, you know, critical mass, either, and usually by the left, let's call it for simplicity's sake. And so I knew that I was either, I felt like I was a civic nationalist, but I got exposed to the quote unquote alt-right around this time. And eventually I, among other websites, you know, there was Amrin, Occidental Observer, a couple of different ones, but I came across Countercurrents and it immediately jumped out as something singular and unique. The metapolitical approach, I had no idea, you know, that term, that, you know, what it meant exactly, but I soon found out. And I just realized not only is Countercurrents a stalwart, focused effort to bring about white well-being, but it's the approach I think is the sanest and most likely to yield results. So it's just my personality. I usually try to scrutinize things for a while, sit back, try to learn, keep my head down, and then commit to something. And I wound up at Countercurrents.
Well, that is a great story. And I really appreciate that. Thank you so much. Yeah. And you've been extremely helpful to Cyan on some various projects. And I appreciate the fact that you're volunteering. Yeah, you're being part of the team.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Absolutely. I have a question here that I think is actually a good question, and then we'll wrap up because I hate how quick these sessions go by. Leo the Lion has written in with the question, what is your favorite spectator sport? I think that's appropriate given that this started out with a lucky bet at a horse race. Robert, what is your favorite spectator sport?
I grew up as a soccer player, very competitive soccer player, and I love the game. I was also a professional soccer coach for 6 years. I'm kind of revealing something about myself, but that's okay. So yes, I mean, soccer is called the beautiful game. It deserves that description. It's strategically very complicated and deep, and it's also a technically very difficult sport. So soccer by far. The horse bet was kind of like the first article. It was the first bet that I've ever made. first sports bet that I ever made. And I made a lot of money on it, just like America's ready for what identity politics. I didn't make a lot of money on it necessarily. Maybe I did or maybe I will. But as far as fundraising is concerned, but yes.
Well, it got a lot of readers, and that's the important thing.
Yes, sir. I'm a lucky boy. I mean, I've had this thing going on. So.
Well, we want you with us as your winning streak continues.
thank you.
James, go
ahead, James. Sorry.
Yeah, what's your favorite spectator sport?
Well, I really don't watch sports, but I kind of like the aesthetic of tennis, to be honest. I don't know why, it just kind of soothes me to watch it.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing. You know, I grew up with a golf-loving mother, and you know, golf tournaments would be on the television and stuff like that. And I always had this attitude that I wanted to put in my living will that if I was ever caught watching golf, you know, they, you know, just pull the plug on me. And, but the funny thing was, is that I was home visiting my mom for a while. She was recovering from an illness and I was helping her out. And I just sat down with her one day and just followed one of these televised golf tournaments. It was on some cable channel. And I have to say that suddenly I got it. Suddenly I got the precision athleticism that these people have. It never really occurred to me just what a sort of brilliant feats they were doing. And just the whole aesthetic of the golf tournament was so uber waspy and very, very appealing to me. So yeah, I have to say I really, really enjoyed that. But as far as going to a place and watching something live, you know, I've never liked watching football on TV, but I went to a football game once and was just totally, suddenly I got why the sport was so cool. And I never enjoyed it watching it on TV. I just get bored and walk away. The same thing with hockey. I had a cousin who played professional hockey. Watching it on TV, nah, you know, but seeing the games live, it was just, I think that for me was my favorite spectator sport, because it's just the sheer grace and brutality mixed together. It's almost Japanese in its combination of grace and brutality, you know, sort of like the samurai aesthetic or something. So yeah, I would have to say watching hockey, but it's got to be live. It's got to be live, or it just doesn't matter to me. It doesn't have any appeal.
A very white sport. I mean, the hockey stadiums are demographically about the same as Trump rallies.
Right. Okay. And we could just do another related question. It's sort of like, are you a Beatles or Stones guy or something? Summer Olympics or Winter Olympics? The Winter Olympics, I go for Winter Olympics, and it's just the uber white Olympics, frankly, the Olympics on ice, the Olympics on snow. I do like watching that.
But, yes.
Well, guys, we've really run out. James, thank you so much.
I've got to say something before I go. First of all, a supporter of ours has just pledged to give $600 to the stream.
Wow.
I know this man personally. I met him in a beautiful mountain town somewhere in the eastern United States. I consider him a personal friend. I think he's one of the most principled, courageous, and also an unbiased thinker. We can talk and he'll understand things that I'm saying if they're true. And so I want to thank him. He knows who he is. Greg and Cyan know who he is. And we just thank you so much, sir.
That puts us over our $1,200 then. Yeah.
There you go. But look, wherever we end up, I will pay the matching grant. Okay. It's, you know, unless it's extravagant, which we hope that it is, but I will pay whatever it ends up as. Before I go, it's when I talked about this heroic impulse that we have, we want to die in the Alamo or something like that. That is a good, healthy thing, but we have to learn to be content. We have to learn to fulfill for that heroic impulse to be fulfilled through philanthropy, because this is the most important thing. Now, if we didn't have any idea how to be successful with the amount of wealth that we had, then it would sort of be, you know, there wouldn't be any point to it. But the point is that we know how to popularize white identity politics. We simply do not have the wealth. And so when you're contributing to the popularization, which we need first, and then the empowerment and the sort of lobby power. And so when I have Aeneas as my avatar, you have Aeneas as the avatar, you are Aeneas. You're founding a new state. You're founding a new Rome. But the way that you do that is through philanthropy. That's simply the situation we're in. Objectively, the situation we're in. So we have to learn how to fulfill that heroic impulse through philanthropy. That is absolutely crucial. If we can do that, we will win. I promise you that.
That is great. Those are wise words to wrap up with. And thank you so much. So we are now at more than $1,200. Folks, this is an exciting time. So please do hit that button. Go follow the links. Go to Entropy. Use Cash App, use the Countercurrents donate page, use Odyssey, if you will, and we will continue this. So thank you very much, both of you guys. I am going to say goodbye. Goodbye, James.
Bye, Robert. Thank you. Bye, Greg.
Bye, James. Bye, Greg.
And I'm going to welcome Carl Thorburn to our show. Welcome, Carl.
Hey, Greg. How are you?
Great, great. Well, it's great to have you on, Carl.
That's very generous of Robert. I didn't realize he was going to be doing the $1,200 matching.
Yeah.
It's good. It's a good use of the horse money.
Yeah, exactly. It's taking ill-gotten gains and laundering
right.
it. And
right,
laundering
right.
it into something good and virtuous. No, I don't think there's anything particularly ill-gotten about winning an honest bet at a horse race.
Yeah, we would have to be a particular sect of some religious group to believe that.
Yeah, exactly. And I want to welcome our friend Gadius Maximus to the show. Hey there.
Hey, my bad, guys.
Hey, I'm glad to have you on. So Gadius is... And I don't want this to sound condescending. Gadius is another one of our normie listeners. He's an ordinary guy, a Countercurrents audience person. Every Countercurrents listener and reader is not ordinary. Okay. You're all above average. It's like the kids at Lake Wobegon schools are all above average in Lake Wobegon. There are people out there who create content, and then there are people out there who are just readers. But some of the readers come forward and help out. And Gadius has been doing this for a couple of years now. He started doing audio readings, then he started moderating streams and just talking us up, sharing our links. He's been great for that. And I really, really appreciate it. And you've got a great voice, so I like your voice. And you do good commentary, too. So I'm glad you're one of the voices of Countercurrents now.
Look into my eyes. I'm the normie now.
Yeah, exactly. We are the normies now. The one YouGov poll says 73% of Republicans believe the kind of stuff that we believe. We need to get those numbers up. I think they're only going to go up.
And the SPLC poll and then another YouGov poll before that on May 24th, it was YouGov Yahoo and it was 61% of Donald Trump voters.
Yeah, that SPLC poll was bonkers, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very encouraging. Yeah, we've been watching the trend just going up in the last month, 61, 68, 73. Soon it'll be 102% of Republicans.
So that's kind of the question I wanted to ask you, Greg. There's, you talked about building institutions, getting a national policy institute type thing together. And one of your goals was to figure out the pulse of our people. And it's kind of like the media is doing your job for you when it comes to like polling white voters or whatever, right? Like you don't even really need to do that.
Well, I think there are ways that we can do it better, though. For instance, the SPLC poll, I think they polled 1,500 people in all of America. Okay, now you can get statistically valid results with 1,500 people around America, but I think it would be much more interesting to do more fine-grained polling. And specifically, what I would love to do is I'd like to break it down into all 435 congressional districts. Right. And poll 1,500 people in every one of those districts. And then you're getting to huge numbers. Right. But that would be fascinating. Of course, you couldn't do all the districts at once. It would be too expensive for one thing. You'd be talking more than $1 million to do.
What's interesting kind of about those fine grained polls where you're polling like, 4,000 people or whatever. With those, you can start finding correlations that you would never expect to find.
Absolutely.
And that type of data is incredibly useful for fundraising and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one thing I would like to do. I'd like to start doing these polls, do them in congressional district size chunks, because that is most relevant to what political changes we can expect. But do really fine-grained questions and ask them even questions that might be a little out of the ordinary. I'd love to find out information about people's education. I'd like to find out about their religious affiliations, things like that, because we might find that there are all kinds of patterns that we hadn't noticed in that data. And we've just got to ask, wouldn't it be interesting to know just what percentage of people who are early adopters of white identitarian ideas were homeschooled? I would think it's above the national average, but I don't know. I'd like to know that answer. What percentage are Presbyterians as opposed to Methodists or something like that? I would like to know that. I think that would allow us to be much more scientific and precise in our various forms of outreach. You know, I'd like to have come break white identity politics down into like five essential questions. Find out how many people agree with 5 out of 5, 4 out of 5, 3 out of 5, and then find the sticking points, you know, the things that bother people. Okay, why is it 4 out of 5? Why is this the point that you disagree with? And then drill down into that. That's how we move the ball. And here's the thing. We've been doing amazingly well. We've been doing amazingly well as amateurs. I'm an amateur sociologist, right? I'm an amateur political scientist. I'm not a professional at this. And most of the people involved in our movement aren't. We're not professionals at this. We're dedicated amateurs. And yet we've had such a success in getting these memes circulating again. So what would we accomplish if we got really professional about it? That's amazing to contemplate.
And not just that, it's in spite of like all the censorship, in spite of everything, you know, the regime has thrown at this side of things since 2017, everything's still grown. Like everybody on this side of things. I mean, some people have gone away or whatever, but most of the mainstays, everybody's grown since 2017. Like more people have come over, and just that's what these polls pretty much prove. Like these ideas are leaking into the mainstream.
Yeah. Well, you know, Greg, you said something really good early on was you said, we're not the driving force. We're like the finishing school. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was pretty insightful, but I think, you know, I think it's true. Like the facts on the ground are what drives people in our direction. But I think that we can, like, as we get more professional, we can start to become the introduction, you know, like for a lot of people who are approaching this from even possibly an antagonistic point of view. You know, there are many people out there, I think, that on the face of it would be very like emotionally revolted by our ideas. But then once they encounter decent people like us communicating those ideas in intelligent ways, they could very well end up falling into our side pretty quickly.
Yeah, I agree with that. One of the things that is a problem for us is that we are generally invisible. I mean, there are certain people out there who are making themselves very visible. The optics people often complain about the people who are most visible. Mm-hmm. But there is a certain truth about it. Years ago, I went to Sweden and I gave a talk, and it was about getting to the tipping point. I had been reading The Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell, and it was a revelatory book, right, to me, because I'm not a practical kind of guy. And this is full of like practical stuff about marketing and so forth. And I was like, whoa, this is a revelation. But anyway, I read this book and I was thinking about how we could get our ideas to the tipping point. And one of the things was visibility. And then I related this to Gus Van Sant's movie about Harvey Milk. And I stood up in front of a bunch of Nordic Viking types, very macho Nordic audience, and told them that, you know, actually, we really need to take a page from Harvey Milk and the gay rights movement of the 1970s. But there's a truth to it, because there was this proposition that was basically to fire homosexuals who were school teachers in the state of California. And this was being put forward by the moral majority and stuff like that. And it was polling well. And Harvey Milk, who was an extremely, extremely bad optics guy, you know, he would begin his speeches with, "I'm Harvey Milk and I'm here to recruit you," you know, that kind of stuff. Anyway, Harvey Milk said, you know, the trouble here is that vanguard homosexuals like himself were bad optics. I mean, he didn't openly admit it, but that's basically what he was admitting, that the homosexual vanguard pride parade people were bad optics, and that ordinary gay folks needed to become more visible. Because it would be easy for people to vote for this referendum if they actually didn't know any ordinary, decent gay people, right? Mm-hmm. And so he wanted people to come out. If your veterinarian who takes care of your dog is known to be gay, you're not going to push that button. That's what he was basically arguing. Now, I don't know if it made all the difference, but the thing went down to defeat. But it's a good point because I was in Sweden at the time, and it turned out that more than 20% of Swedes polled at that point were sympathetic to the Sweden Democrats. And I was sitting in the room, the breakfast room at this hotel, and I was saying, you know, one out of five people in this room actually already agrees with us, and we don't know who they are.
Yeah.
Right? They're all invisible. You know, our people are going to be the majority someday. And as long as they're invisible because they're intimidated, and that means that the enemy has control over our optics. And we have to think of ways of seizing that opportunity. And at a certain point, we're going to be so many that we can just be more open about it. And once more ordinary, wholesome people say, you know, I'm worried about white demographic decline too, that's going to normalize us. And that's going to really get us to the tipping point, I think.
That's why, you know, I'm actually a fan of Nick Fuentes. I think that, you know, despite all of his shortcomings, I think just the fact that he's out there making a ruckus and a lot of younger people are paying attention to him, that's, he's kind of creating a space for people to agree, even sort of at the fringe. They could say, well, I don't fully go along with what Nick is saying, but I think he has a good point here and here and here. And that's sort of the way you do it, right? You kind of, I don't know that I fully buy into the, everybody has to wear the khakis and the white collared shirt and things like that. Like that's not, I mean, it's got a place, but it's definitely not necessary.
Yeah. So I want to bring Rich Hauck into the conversation. Just let me say hi, Rich. Hey, Rich, how are you?
Good.
Hey, how are you, Rich?
Hey, nice color cat you got there.
Thanks. Yeah. It's my favorite color.
Yeah, yeah. It's his Bond villain cat. Yeah.
It is. Long hair and everything.
Yeah, yeah. So I have a couple questions here that we can sort of debate. One is this issue of people who have left us. Gadius was mentioning that. I can think of a few people who have left us. Richard Spencer's former right-hand guy or third to the left guy or whatever, Evan something or
Evan
other.
Evan McLaren, yeah.
McLaren, yeah, he made some noise.
He's living in, I probably Norway. Shouldn't say, but he's living in a very white country right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, rip Bozo.
R.I.P. Bozo.
Yeah, and then, of course, Richard really has left us. Mark, who was on earlier, sort of bullied him on some stream into saying, I'm not part of the right. I don't want to be part of the right. So Richard has left us. The question is, though, when people leave us, is it because their convictions change? I guess I want to explore that. I remember years ago when Don Black's son, Derek, declared that he loved multiculturalism and all that kind of stuff. I just wondered, did he really believe to begin with? Do people who really believe what we believe for the right reasons change their minds? Or is it that the turncoats, they didn't really believe, or they didn't believe for the right reason? Or as Evan McLaren said, he was only doing this because he's an asshole, right? And now he's trying to be a better person. I would like to know people who sincerely have had a change of heart. I'd like to know how and why. Obviously, if my worldview has huge holes in it, I'd like to know what they are.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that in the case of Evan McLaren, he did it because he was worried that people in Norway would Google his name and find out about his past. And, you know, so he wanted to basically get articles published so that people would find the articles showing that he renounced it. But I very seriously doubt that these people fundamentally change their understanding of human nature and race and everything like that. What's going on is that they're reshuffling their priorities. So they're saying, okay, well, they're willing to make a sacrifice for their race's survival and future in order to, in the short term, or what they perceive to be the short term, the remainder of their own lives, just sort of blend back into the normie sphere. And I guess that's possible, but it's like, it's a really unfulfilling way to live, if you ask me, because it's like living a lie and knowing it, and it's got to wear on you, is what I'm saying. I can't imagine doing it.
Yeah, I don't know how you could make the conscious decision to go back and not tell the truth, right? After you learn the truth, what's going on, how you could be like, oh, I'm just not going to tell the truth anymore because I'm scared or I don't want people to look at me sideways. I don't know that as far as Spencer and McLaren are concerned, I honestly don't even really think they were in the first place on this side of things. Spencer, I mean, he's just, his ego or whatever. And he just wanted people to pay attention to him. McLaren, I was reading up on him after he did his little blog post or whatever, trying to, deflect heat off himself. And I guess he ran some type of blog or something called Right Leninist, which to me, just being a normal American familiar with world history or whatever, that doesn't even make any sense. It's sort of a contradiction in terms. So
wait, so he called himself a white or a right Leninist?
Yeah. Right Leninist.
Golly.
Yeah. Thule-Tide needs to write an expose on this. Another Duganist, right? Another Nazbol. I don't know what the guy was up to. In my interactions with him early on in Countercurrents' life, I was looking for new writers, and he had written a couple of things here and there. And he was friends with Greg Hood, for instance, and so I reached out to him. And he basically just said that he didn't feel like he was able to write. And what he said, I'm not going to go into any details, but what he said basically just sounded like a huge gnawing inferiority complex. Hmm. And so I just sort of let him be, and he would send his little donations in, and he was supportive of Countercurrents, for which he has apologized to Richard Spencer publicly, etc. And that was about it. And then in 2017, he pops back up pretending to be friendly as part of this sort of op that Richard Spencer and Daniel Freeberg were running, thinking they could drive me out of the movement. And so I knew right then he was just a complete snake. I've seen absolutely nothing that would contradict that. But yeah, if he was in this for the wrong reasons, I'm happy to let him go. I want people who are in this for the right reasons. We're not going to win with people who are doing this for the wrong reasons anyway. I got a donation here from INM, $19.80. Thanks to all at Countercurrents for the great work. If you've been around for more than a few years, you can see that despite recent massive censorship, we've grown so much over the years in our institutions and numbers. Media to Rise, Gab, Patriot Front, and American Renaissance, Optics Matters. Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. Years ago, Hugh McDonald and I did something, I think it was in 2014, 2015. And I called us the original Optics Cucks. Later on, after that term came out, I republished transcripts of these talks with the headline, the original Optics Cucks. It's not a bad brand. Optics does matter. So that's good. I also want to just raise, I want to ask you guys some of these little fun questions since people are paying for it and it's being doubled and it's coming out of Robert's pocket and we appreciate it. So guys, how about this reincarnation question, if you could be reincarnated as any other European ethnicity, which one would it be? Carl, you want to go first?
I really like the answer of Italian, but I'm trying to think. I'm mostly Scottish, actually, according to my ancestry.com. So I think maybe Southern European. I would go for Italian. They can withstand the sun better too.
Yeah. How about you, Rich?
A different one.
You're an American. So if you came back let's just say that our ethnicity is American. Okay. So you can come back as any other European ethnicity.
Oh, well, since I'm half German and half Greek, I would pick one of those so I could feel at home again.
Okay. Very cool. And what about you, Gadius?
I got the LARPy Roman nickname, so it'd be Italian too.
I hope Ted Salas is out there listening to this. He's the guy who constantly harps on how the movement is filled with basically true romance watchers who are constantly going on about how Italians are all mixed with Negroes and You know, we're all Madison Grant, Nordis's snobs. It's really quite amazing the percentage of white nationalists I know in the United States who are part Italian. And if they aren't, or are just Italian, and if they're not Italian, they wish they would be in another way. So I think this is really, really interesting. So anyway, that's a good question.
I see that too. And I always find these pictures from the coast in Italy of these beautiful villas and balconies and or, you know, maybe more modern photos of there was one in this courtyard of a white Lamborghini with chickens running around. And I'll post them in chats and I'll say, like, I'll put the caption every time, like, Italians live like this and Anglo's really going to call them not white. And or we'll say something along like, you know, Italians are living like this and Nordicists will call them not white. And, you know, just because they live in such a, like, almost the way you might stereotype how a European lives, like that's sort of how a lot of them actually live.
And it's when Bitcoin goes back up, we should buy one of those empty abandoned Italian villages and park our Lamborghinis there.
right It's just like they live in the most European way humanly possible, and then people are like, yeah, they're not white.
Yeah, every little Italian town that you've never heard of looks like a movie set or a postcard or something.
Right.
Like that. Yeah. I have a friend who just moved to the town that his Italian grandfather was born in. I'd never heard of this town. So I looked it up. Oh, it's been there since the 6th century BC, you know, and it's got all these magnificent buildings and it's in this beautiful countryside. Never heard of it, but there are a million little towns in Italy you've never heard of that are as beautiful as Venice or Rome or, it's just the way they live because they have high standards. They've got the highest standards of aesthetics and amazing craftsmanship standards there. And they just make material life extremely beautiful.
And also they don't seem to be uptight workaholics. You know, they're a little bit kind of laid back.
Yeah, they take like two-hour breaks to have espresso in the middle of the work.
Right, right.
That's like unheard of in America.
Dang, I do that too.
Yeah. But, you know, they manage to still live extremely well, which is a wonderful thing. So, yeah, I think a certain amount of Southern European aesthetics and the Southern European work ethic are actually very, very healthy things. Alan Watts talked about how he actually thought that Americans, who are supposedly extremely materialistic, were not that materialist. And the reason why is he said that American cities are often extremely ugly. American food is often indigestible and unpalatable and horrible to look at and smells bad too. And he said, real materialists would not live in ugly houses and ugly cities, drive ugly cars, and eat awful food. The real materialists are the French. French materialism means beautiful architecture, walkable, beautiful cities, extremely good food, et cetera. And of course, Italians are materialist in that sense too. They exist in the material world very, very well.
Can you imagine what Alan Watts would think of modern America if he were still around?
Oh, the poor guy. Yeah, he would have been just appalled. But I do think he would have loved Donald Trump, but that's just my opinion.
I agree. Some hope.
There's a, some hope there. You know how, I mean, I've talked to everybody on the show about how I've kind of gotten into the history of fashion and clothing a bit. And it's pretty much French and Italian, since we're kind of on the topic of the materialism. And there's this book I'm reading now called Swan Song, Souvenirs of Paris Elegance. And it's about this guy kind of just goes to Paris and he's looking for the best craftsmanship and clothing that you can find. And it's just his, what he finds and talking about that. And it's just really interesting. And you just see these people, they take simple clothing to the absolute highest levels that it can be taken to. And they do the same thing with food. And like you mentioned, architecture, and then you see it with cars. Or if you talk cars, you have to throw the Germans in there too. But it's just the spirit of even, I almost can't even call it materialism because that carries such a negative connotation of it. It's something more when they are taking an everyday item to its absolute zenith. And that's something that's very cool and really pretty particular to just a handful of groups around the world.
Well, you know, Rich, I've noticed that I'll be scrolling through Facebook and they insert little videos like TikTok videos in the feed. And some of the ones that get the most views, like 8-9 million views, are actually videos of like short little clips of European craftsmen carving something or, you know, making something beautiful.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And it's And it's like, you know, you'll click on the comments and it's like the comments are like, you know, there's a bunch of, you know, we see like black people like saying like, oh man, these guys are so boss, you know, like they're just really amazed by it.
Yeah. I saw a similar one and it was a dude like stitching a shoe together or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, something that you kind of take like in a previous time, it'd be like, oh, you know, a cobbler, that's okay, whatever. But now it's the coolest thing. It's sort of making an interesting comeback on social media, like you said.
That's how you get laid. You know, you have a really good skill like that.
Yeah, right. For sure.
Well, hey, our friend Vico Hessler has shown up. Vico, welcome to the show. Sorry for this mix up that we had earlier. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. I'm last but not least, it seems.
Yes, well,
I actually think it was a problem on my end, I'm afraid. It was an unfortuitous time for my email to update their settings.
Oh, so we were going into spam or something?
No, I think it was maintenance, I'm afraid, but I'm here now. Okay. At the last second.
Okay, well, it's great to have you on board. You've been writing over the last couple of years for Countercurrents every once in a while, and you're another excellent stylist. Very impressed with your work. And I thought, well, you know, I know you've got fans out there and you're going to have more fans as you continue writing. So I thought it would be great to introduce you and just have a quick get acquainted on this stream. So welcome.
Yes, I think some of your listeners may be familiar with my articles. I primarily write about current affairs, but I also do write about the historical and esoteric. My objective, as far as I see it, is to try and dispel the barrage of negative mass media that we're getting at the moment. So when I do write articles, I try and, as far as I can, inspire people. That's kind of my main motivation, I would say.
Well, I think you're very successful at that. And I'm always happy to hear from you. So how did you discover Countercurrents and how did you become a dissident writer?
Well, I've been involved in the ethno-nationalist movement for about 15 years. My early influences were the great right-wing speakers of the day. So, you know, Dr. William Pierce and Jonathan Bowden. I was sort of, and maybe it's a bit of a heresy to say, but I was less influenced by right-wing authors and philosophers and more by those kind of speakers, because in the mid-2000s, the ethno-nationalist movement, at least in the UK, was primarily a political and street movement. So at that time, you know, we had the British National Party gaining 1 million votes in the European elections. And it sort of seemed possible at that time that we might have a kind of new English revolution. But I mentioned Jonathan Bowden because that was actually how I came to Countercurrents, you know, through your interviews at the time. So that's kind of how I came into it, I would say.
Well, that's really gratifying. I put these things out there and I know people are listening to them, but I don't know the stories. I don't know who is encountering this for the first time, that kind of stuff. And it's always really interesting to hear those stories. And some of them trickle through. I've had people write to me and say, yeah, I started reading Countercurrents because I Googled and found a review you did of The Dark Knight or something like that. I've had more than a few people say that specific review. So it's always neat to know the actual stories, though. Again, you put this out there, you know it's being read by somebody, but it's nice to put a name to that anonymous statistic, right?
Well, I think Jonathan and yourself were kind of involved in a similar process of intellectualizing the movement and creating an accessible pantheon of reactionaries that we could get involved with. I think people, a lot of the new members of this movement, might not be aware, but before 2015-16, there wasn't really an intellectual basis. It was very much a kind of electoral street movement. And Jonathan obviously was involved with promoting figures like Evola, Mishima, you know, Heidegger, and lots of other figures like that. And I think Countercurrents has also been vital in intellectualizing the movement. And that's why I've gone to say happy birthday. It might be somewhat belated, but, you know, I think it's been a real boon to the movement and to people of the future that are joining in now.
Well, it's still our birthday. And folks, we're going to keep going on this stream for a while. Let's just refresh and see where we are. Okay. A couple from Dylan Folk at Entropy. He sends two $3 donations. He says, people who leave the dissident right never believed it in the first place, or they're just shitty people and they don't care about throwing the truth under the bus. I mean, that is a possibility that, they believed it was true on some level, but psychologically speaking, things are more important to them than the truth. And so they're willing to toss that aside. They're willing to live with lies or live a lie. They want to be plugged back into the matrix, right? They want to take the blue pill. They want to be like Mr. Regan. And they'll sell out. I mean, that is a human possibility. It's a despicable possibility, but people are capable of being despicable, right? And then he adds, having said that, Richard Spencer is something of an exception. He's generally thought himself into these new positions, but he's never gone out and denied the reality of race or advocating for white people.
I haven't heard him advocate for white people in like 2 years. So
yeah, it's bizarre. Like he's if you follow him on Twitter, which I don't anymore, I had to unfollow him because it was just, he was getting on my nerves, but it's just like, it's perpetually contrarian positions to the point that he was virtually indistinguishable from like following the World Economic Forum
or Rachel Maddow. Yeah, people were making this, like having this online game. Is it Spencer or is it Maddow?
right.
Can you tell them apart anymore? I don't think he genuinely thought himself into any new positions. I don't think on some level that we're dealing with a person here with deep convictions. I think we're dealing with something else. And I'm not too curious exactly what it is. And I don't want to get close enough to find out. But yeah, I think we're dealing with somebody that you could describe as toxic and who, you know, advocates things or disavows things probably for the wrong reasons or for no real reasons at all. I mean, I said it once. I said his positions are not to be analyzed. They're to be diagnosed.
right.
And that's sort of
it. I did actually briefly meet Spencer once at an event, and I asked him about William Luther Pierce, and he practically ran away. So I'm not sure that he was ever really too committed in that sense.
I think you guys are right with these. I would just offer like one addition about people. I think for the most part, people leave because, you know, like you said, the social pressures, or maybe they didn't really believe it. But one thing I've noticed that happens, I was actually talking to Buttercup about this the other day, and he kind of mentioned it in the chat, that like I've noticed with a lot of people who are sort of popular, like on Telegram, for example, and they have like a couple different clicks. Like I read some of their feeds and I have like very little in common with them. Like I see the issues that really bother them or their kind of takes on modern society or like, you know, historical society and just everything. And I'm like, I just don't have anything in common with this person, like culturally, aesthetically, politically. Like they're just very little that I see in certain parts of what consider themselves the dissident sphere. And maybe they still are dissident. Like, you know, I'm not saying they're not. It's just, you know, I look at it and I think, you know, that's not really like that doesn't really represent my views or interests or anything I'd really be a part of. And I wonder if sometimes, you know, things take that turn and people think, if this is what it means to be dissident, right, maybe that's not me. And I've never taken that position. I've taken the position that, like, I still have the same views. And these other people are just some sort of weirdos. Like, you know, I narcissistically don't blame myself, right? I think it's a them problem. But I think that could happen. I definitely don't think it happened with like Spencer or McLaren. I think they were just problematic from the get-go. But I think, you know, I could see other people looking around and saying, oh, geez, this is 90% of what these people are talking about is ridiculous. Their takes are bad. What they're saying is not in line. You know, I see people say stuff like, oh, you know, it's not blacks at all that are a problem. It's the people letting them in. Blacks are just fine. And, you know, like I've lived around them and that's not true. You know, they are a problem kind of unto themselves. And But when I see takes like that, I think, oh, you know, that's kind of ridiculous. And that could be a reason people, you know, just don't feel like it is their place anymore or want to be around it anymore.
Right. There's something I call the churn. I remember Matt Parrott once explaining something to me. Matt would say the stuff that was quiet out loud, and he was one of the most cynical people I ever knew. And he would explain this to me, you know, his cynical takes on things, and I'd be utterly shocked. And eventually I just sort of stopped being his friend. But he explained to me that the way that he would get people to comment on things is that he would take a defensible position and state it in a half-assed or somewhat indefensible way. And then there would be a lot of discussion. And so he would just sort of enjoy the churning of you know, he'd like throw the bait in the piranha tank and watch the churning going on and enjoy
it's
that.
It's kind of a pseudo clickbait, really, I suppose.
Yeah,
strategy.
Yeah.
I've seen he's baited me multiple times on Twitter, and I always ignore the tweets.
Yeah. Well, once you get the game, it's just, yeah, exactly. Well, there are a lot of people in our sphere who just do that. They're selling their little videos on YouTube and stuff like that. They're trying to get comments. They're trying to get clicks. They're trying to get mentions. They're trying to create controversy, et cetera. And once you sort of wise to it, it's just like ho-hum. It's ho-hum, and it's like watching a television series, you know, which is one of the most unrewarding things I can think of, you know, because, you know, a TV series will have maybe in an entire season, 2 hours of really good drama and all this padding, right? And they string you along, you know, and it's just all these empty calories to keep you watching. And there's a lot of this movement that's just that it's just trying to create an online they can monetize. Or if they're not monetizing it, they're getting ego gratification out of it, being at the center of things. And yeah. So that's...
Good for them if they can monetize it. But 9 times out of 10, they don't, because they're not clever enough to do that.
Yeah. So we have a few more questions here. I want to ask a question from Mises Skeptic. Mises Skeptic writes in and asks for our thoughts on the return of paleo-libertarianism. Okay, now I know what he's saying here. Back in the 1990s, I believe, I go way back. I was into the libertarian world in the 90s. I remember the rollout of paleo-libertarianism. Paleo-libertarianism was an operation that was sort of pioneered by Murray N. Rothbard and people at the Mises Institute. They looked at David Duke. They looked at the white reaction to affirmative action. They saw racial populism coming down the road, and they wanted to position libertarianism to capture some of that energy. This is when Ron Paul published all those newsletters that he swore he never read and didn't write about affirmative action. And they took a hard turn to the paleo right. And they were being very friendly with Southern nationalists and people like that. Anyway, this was a thing in the 90s. And now we are told that the Mises faction, the Mises caucus, has swept through the Libertarian Party. And what they're trying to do is push away from the cultural leftists and woke tards that are pushing very woke talking points. They want to... tell me if this sounds familiar. They want to embrace a sort of trolling, sort of rough trolling, right-wing internet personality style to make libertarianism more relevant. And basically what this questioner, who's a Mises skeptic, is saying is he thinks this is the return of paleo-libertarianism. So anyway, I wonder, you know, if you guys have any thoughts about this.
I've got a lot of thoughts because I've went down the libertarian rabbit hole again for the past week. I've been trying to put together like basically just a stream, like a one-off stream with a bona fide Mises respecting libertarian and somebody else on our side, you know, that came from libertarianism, because there's a lot of us. There's a lot of us Ron Paul respecters or former Ron Paul respecters that's on this side of things now. And I got to tell you, man, if you think that infighting over here is bad, go over to the libertarians, like trying to find one that's like cool with like every faction. It's nearly impossible. So I reached out to like the first guy I could think of was this dude from years ago I used to watch. He's like a former YouTuber or whatever. And I reached out to him and I was like, hey man, if you could point me to somebody who's like, you know, likes Mises or whatever, likes the Mises caucus to talk to, that'd be nice. And he's like, he basically wrote DM'd me back. He's like, fuck those guys. You know, he's like, I'll quote him. He's like, tell them I said to suck my dick. And, actually, I ended up getting a couple guys from the Libertarian Party, like the actual Libertarian Party, that were interested in talking to me, but they went cold on me. They left me on red. I think, you know, if I want to be charitable to them, I'd say it's probably because they scrolled through my timeline and, you know, saw what I was about and had second thoughts. I reached out to another guy that's on this side of things, and you know, he used to be real big into libertarianism. He came over and he had an actual different take on it. He said he wished the Libertarian Party would actually become more like progressive, because it would split the progressive vote or whatever. It would like make libtards, you know, it split up like between the Green and the Libertarians and the Democrats or whatever. But I don't know. I don't know about that. I think like the Mises caucus thing, I think it's, I'm cautiously optimistic about it, because what are we trying to do here? Greg, you talk about all the time, like we want to get it to where like white identity politics is, what do you call it? What'd you call it? Like it's like the
hegemony.
Hegemony. We're trying to get to hegemony. And that, to me, that seems like a step in the right direction. If these guys are trying to be spicy, they're trying to be like, oh, look, we can be, you know, like radical too. Oh, we're so bad. Some people say they're trying to woo radical right people back over to the Mises or back over to the Libertarian Party. But I mean, that ship's already sailed for the vast majority of the people that's over here. So
yeah.
The only time libertarians get a knock on the door from the FBI is when they are printing 3D printing guns. Like that's it. That, you know, nobody cares what their political views are. You know, if they're saying something online that's too too freedom-y, right? They don't get knocks on the door for that.
yeah. They don't threaten the system. And in fact, libertarian economists will be wheeled out and switched on anytime the oligarchy wants a tax cut. So they have become economized within the overall system, and they're useful to it. They're not threatening to it. I looked at this and I looked at, in the same way that I looked at what Murray Rothbard was doing at the time, I wasn't a race conscious white person, but I was cynical about what they were doing and thought, we don't want these racists. That was really my inclination. I sort of sneered at that. Although there are some intellectually interesting people in the sort of Southern nationalist world that I would love to have had conversations with, et cetera, at that time. But anyway, I just thought it was a cynical thing. And I look at this today and I think, okay, these people know very well that there was a libertarian to alt-right pipeline, and they want to see if they can reverse that. Okay, whatever their motives are, is not going to work. People are not going to go back from our position to libertarianism. And if the Mises caucus people push out some of the most repulsive woke libtard people in the Libertarian Party, well, that might make the Libertarian Party a little more appealing to white people, and that might give them a little bit of life. But anybody with a shred of racial consciousness and pride is not going to stay long in the Libertarian Party. So it's not really going to be an effective trap, I think. And really, what it's going to be is it's going to be another position, another part of the culture, another part of the political spectrum that we can bring people over from.
Well, they operate fundamentally in a white infrastructure. That's kind of the crux of their ideology, in a sense, that everything that they try to do only operates within a white infrastructure. If they were operating outside of that, they wouldn't be able to implement any of the policies that they want to see.
It's totally implicitly white. Yeah.
Yeah. Very much.
Yeah.
It's like they're LARPing as living in a totalitarian state, when in fact the only way that they could play tough like that is when they're living in a high trust society, right? They can only do what they're doing in a white society. But, you know, when I was a libertarian, like back in 2012 or something, there was this girl named Kathy Reasonwitz. And, she got really popular in the libertarian groups. And, you know, but she basically, she moved too fast, right? She started out being libertarian, and then within a year or two, she was already trying to drag everybody over to her crazy far left positions on everything. And the same thing happened with Brian Kaplan, who I'm sure you guys know. Brian Kaplan is the economist who wrote the book on open borders.
Oh yeah,
advocating for open borders. Mm. And it's not even subtle at all. And when you're a Jewish economist and you're advocating for open borders like that, it's like, dude, you're playing the role that we define every day. So they're shooting themselves in the foot. The Libertarian Party is just, they're not sending their best, as Trump would say.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think it's an opportunity, not a crisis. You know, there are two ways of looking at these things. You can think, oh my God, we're going to be co-opted. It's all over. I don't think anybody's going to get co-opted by libertarianism or corralled by it. It's kind of cute that they're trying, though. I kind of have to give them credit for that. It's sort of flattering. Imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, et cetera, et cetera. They're trying to get some of the alt-right online energy and grift a little off that. And I don't think it's going to be ultimately successful. It's going to make libertarianism less cringe for a while. But nobody of any value will be lost to that.
I don't know, Greg. He should have heard the things I heard. I was listening to a couple of their podcasts, and they're, you know, basically jizzing their pants.
Generation Holocaust survivors. And
yeah, we've got Joe Rogan and Tim Pool on our side. We're going to win, guys.
Yeah, okay. Well, but that is less cringe than Kathy Reasonwitz, though. Kathy Reasonwitz was so appalling that she basically practically single-handedly created the right stuff. Just, sheer reaction to her kind of cringe.
Right.
She was one of the driving forces behind that whole crystallization that gave us the PRS at a certain point.
Yeah.
That's going to continually happen to them. I mean, they've got no objective morality and therefore no standards. So, I mean, you talk about co-option, but it's them that are going to be co-opted because anyone can walk through the door and does. And obviously the leadership of those libertarian movements tends to facilitate these sort of people. So I'm not massively worried about that, to be honest.
Yeah, well, I'm not massively worried too.
One time somebody took, this is probably 10, 15 years ago. Matt Parrott told me this story more recently. Actually, he told it to me in Charlottesville. And he told me at some point, like 15 or 10 years ago, somebody took him to a libertarian convention. And they were kind of doing some outreach, trying to get people a little bit maybe further right than libertarianism. And somebody was struck up a conversation with him and asking him his views, kind of checking out his libertarian credentials. And he said, I believe a big issue for me is freedom to associate and, of course, to not associate. And he said it was just like he was swarmed by people who were like, what do you mean exactly by to not associate? And they were just, the idea being he disagreed with things like the Civil Rights Act and the Fair Housing Act.
Yes, absolutely.
And he was kind of trying to softly step into that territory. And he said they just like smelled him out, sniffed him out, and attacked him pretty much within 10 minutes of him being there.
Yeah, the core of the Libertarian Party are either Jewish or spiritually equivalent to Jews.
Yeah, he said he noticed quite a few Jews around him suddenly.
Yeah. They have very, very finely attuned antennas for anything like that.
Yeah.
We also have a question here from Dan. Dan asks, do you think that questioning the Holocaust narrative will eventually become illegal in the United States? Rich, you're a lawyer. What do you think about this? Will the First Amendment be put on a pyre and immolated to prevent people from raising questions about the Holocaust?
No, I don't think so. And I think the reason that it won't be made illegal is that in the U.S., you have an interesting way that the left is getting around things like the First and Second Amendment. And that's essentially by outsourcing it to corporations.
Yeah.
And so it's like, let's say you go on record saying, I don't think 6 million Jews died in the Holocaust. I think it was mostly exaggerated. I don't think there's 6 million bodies. I don't think there's 6 million bodies worth of ash. I don't think, you know, you do the whole thing, right? Somebody comes across it and they clip the recording of you saying it. They find screenshots and, you know, they send it to your employer. They make an article about you on what's the one stop. I think it's a nonprofit of some sort, but it's called Stop Antisemitism. They have a big social media presence and they work with several other Jewish organizations. And, you know, if they catch somebody doing a Holocaust denial, they will tag their employer in the post. They will contact the school. I've had these people contact the Ohio bar for me because of things I said. I think what I said was more about Israel. But anyway, it wasn't even like the things that they included in their complaint about me. It wasn't even like Fed posty or things that it was egregious. It was, you know, kind of basic stuff. Like one was showing two posts from Ben Shapiro where, you know, he said essentially that Israel has a right to shoot Palestinians if they come up to the border, and then juxtaposing that with his like, I don't care if America Browns and all of his like pro American open borders things, right? It was a bunch of things like that. And what they will do is they'll try to get you fired. They'll try to get you a professional license suspended. They don't need to censor you with like a fine from the government. They have all kinds of other ways that they will go about doing it. And I think they're satisfied with that. And, you know, that's something that will probably need dealt with or resolved or a workaround for people. You know, because it's not just limited. The thing is about Holocaust denial, that's within a whole cluster of sort of, you know, opinions you can't really have associated with your real name and profession and that sort of thing. Right. So I don't think they're going to do like an explicit hate speech. The last time an issue came up, there was I forget the name of it. But anyway, it was a band calling themselves the Slants, I think. And this case went up to the Supreme Court because somebody denied them, some government agency maybe used, they wanted a copyright or something, and it was denied because they said it was racist. And the band sued, and this went up to the Supreme Court. I think it was 2015. It was more recent. And they were like, hey, there's no hate speech carve out in the First Amendment. You can't, just because you don't like somebody using a slur for their band name doesn't mean you can prohibit them from a copyright or whatever government service they were trying to get, right? I don't think that's going to change, especially with the current court. But, you know, they will just use their sway with corporations. This Stop Anti-Semitism group has a ton of connections. I bet that they know who all donates to them. So if they see some VP at Chase donate to them and they find somebody doing a Holocaust denial or a racism online, they could, you know, maybe they call up the guy who donates and says, hey, this person in your company, or hey, you know, there's a dean of student life at a school where they find somebody doing anti-Semitism, and they call them up and make your life more difficult. They have all sorts of, you know, ways to do this, and that's essentially what they do.
That is a very good, thorough answer. I want to move to another one because we've got a few other questions here. I want to bring on Cyan again. Cyan.
Thank you so much. I'm here.
Okay. And there was a question we wanted to have you on. Somebody sent us $285. And for that, we're going to have you back on. The question is, if Greg Johnson wants to read my chat, what advice do you have for people in the dissident right who are raising children? Well, my advice is to listen to Cyan because she actually has a child. So what are your thoughts on this? And then we'll go around the panel and get some other thoughts too.
I think this is great. And I'll also, I have to clarify, you don't have to have children to offer advice on parenting, because we were all children at some point, and a lot of us remember that, but
right.
It certainly helps. So everyone's comments are valid here, especially Greg's too. But I would say, as someone, my daughter is 10 right now, and the best thing that you can do is just spend time with them, spend time talking to them about your observations of the world. And I don't mean this, pointing out things and making them political, right? Because we don't need to do that. The thing about being proud of your heritage and happy with your white identity is that it's natural. It comes naturally to us. And so all we really have to do is foster that love of your culture and also cater the kind of content that you're bringing into the home. So, I made a comment earlier, going back a little bit, everything that we watch together, we watch a lot of older movies, and the TV shows that she does watch are also curated, and we watch it together. You know, she never sits in front of the TV just blindly watching a show. But some of the favorite things that I've picked out are My Little Pony. I almost called it My Nationalist Pony because that's the title of Buttercup Dew, who is in the chat right now. So Buttercup Dew, thanks so much for your comments on My Little Pony. When I was reading, when you did the interview with Greg Johnson, my daughter was really into My Little Pony at the time, and I was watching it as well. And I was thinking, wow, this is really wholesome. This has a pro-nationalist message, especially that I don't know the person who asked the question, I don't know if your, kids are girls or boys or whatever, but regardless, it's a great show, and it definitely, it celebrates differences in a good way. And so that's good material. We also, but now that she's 10 and we're homeschooling, there's a lot of good movies out there that are related to history and the topics that we're covering. I'm really happy that she's old enough to enjoy Lawrence of Arabia, for example. She's in fifth grade, and we were able to watch it together and discuss some of the history behind it. And we were able to talk about topics such as nationalism, colonialism. And I made a little worksheet out of it, for us to talk about discussion points. And she actually read Greg's review of Lawrence of Arabia that's online at Countercurrent. So if somebody could post that in the chat, I'll find it too after I'm done answering this question. But there's a lot of good material out there at Countercurrents for homeschooling too, once you get to that level. And it's just been so fulfilling to be able to have these conversations with her and have her enjoy what I enjoy too. So that's good. A note on homeschooling. We didn't homeschool the whole way through. We started homeschooling. I didn't really think I was capable of it, I guess, but we started homeschooling during COVID. So that's one of the good things that came out of COVID. So like a lot of other parents, I realized what they were actually learning in school. And I said to myself, well, gosh, I can do that myself. They don't have to spend 7 hours being indoctrinated somewhere else. I can do it in my own home in 2 hours or maybe 3 hours. And we can go over our own topics. So I think if you can do it, it's really, really valuable. And, schooling doesn't have to happen during the day, during work hours. You can, if you have a full-time job, you can do it at night, in the evenings, on weekends. It's really good to spend that quality time with your children. And there are a lot of resources out there. So, I could go on for a while too with more of these resources that I found. You're welcome to email me too. It's Cyan, that's C-Y-A-N at counter-currents.com. And I'm happy to share with you just all of the things that the nationalist community has been posting and sharing so that you can really give your kids a good handle on their own culture, history, and pride in their heritage.
Well, that's lovely. That's beautiful. Gadius, you're a dad. Do you have any thoughts you'd like to share?
Basically, just tell your kids the truth and demand that they tell the truth also. Everything else will pretty much take care of itself. Don't tell them, look, there's obviously things that aren't true. Like, you know, people aren't equal. Like, everybody's not equal. And, you know, just that's, everything will take care of itself if you do that. What I do is I tell my kids what I believe. I tell them, you know, my views, and I let them make up their own mind. And I just try to instill character in them by making them tell the truth and telling them the truth, not lying to them.
That's great. How many kids do you have?
Two.
Yeah. The one thing I'll say about this is something I've been saying for years, and it bears repeating. There's a whole bunch of fake psychology that floats out around there, out in the culture. And the biggest piece of fake psychology is that if you try and teach your children values, they'll rebel. So there's no point in even trying. Now, the people who push that completely false view are the very same people who want to teach your kids about twerking and global warming in school and don't believe for a minute that trying to teach them these values will cause them inevitably to rebel. And so there's no point in doing it. The reason why people tell parents not to teach their values to their kids is that they want them delivered into the hands of the schools as a blank slate so that these teachers can fill them up with all the twaddle that they want to dictate. But the truth is, we know from science and we know it from common sense and experience that your parents are the people who have the most influence on your worldview and your values. If you don't abdicate that power to the culture distorters and the television, to the school teachers and things like that, if you abdicate the power, they will take over your kids' minds. But if you take responsibility for the power that you have and just teach them, you have a huge influence on them, and you can inoculate your kids from a lot of nonsense out there. And you don't even have to be really, really preachy or teachy about it, because kids learn by imitation. They see, that's how they learn language. They learn by imitating. That's how they learn values. They learn by imitating. They see you making judgments and distinctions and you pointing out differences in the world, and then they can't unsee those things. So it doesn't even have to be something that's really preachy or teachy. It just happens in the matter of course. And so the most important thing is that if you throw away the power to influence your kids' values, other people are happy to pick that up and twist their minds. And you don't want that to happen.
Sian said something about curating, you know, what they see, what you bring into your home. And that's good. But what I do also is, like, if there's a movie or my kids listening to some type of music, I'll analyze it with them. And so, you know, I grew up listening to rap music. I still, you know, every now and then I dabble in a little bit of it. But one of my kids likes rap music, and I'll listen to it with them, and I'll be like, look, there's like 3 or 4 major themes to every song. There's drugs, there's sex, there's violence, and then there's money. Every other lyric that comes up, it's either going to fall under these 4 categories. And we'll just sit there and listen to a song. We'll be like, okay, that one was about drugs, that one was about sex. And that's something you could do to inoculate your kids to, you know, the culture, because once they get old enough, you're not going to be able to helicopter parent them forever, right? They're gonna learn about stuff in the outside world. And you talked about that Don Black kid, his kid that went to college. And, you know, I think, like, what happened there was, I don't know, maybe he was just, because I tried to listen to a book that was written about him a few months ago, and it was written by some, you know, some libtard or whatever. And I got about a quarter way through it, and I was like, all right, this is just a waste of my time. But I think what happened there was he just wasn't prepared for the outside world. He wasn't, like, you know, told, like, hey, this is, you know, what people think. This is, he was too insular. I see that, and no disrespect to, like, you know, homeschool children. It's becoming increasingly apparent that that's going to be the only option sooner or later. But I grew up, and there's a lot of homeschool kids I knew, and, you know, they didn't really know how to, you know, behave like the rest of us. Now, whether that's a good or bad thing, that's up to you. But we are a social animal. Human beings are a social animal, and you've got to like know how to get along with the outside world, or at least know how to like blend in with it. So I just say like analyzing cultural stuff with your children, like popular culture or whatever, and ridiculing it and making fun of it. If it's something ridiculous, just be like, look how stupid that is. So that's probably another pointer I'd give.
I don't disagree with you either. I mean, in terms of the socialization aspect, and you know, I am a big fan of private school too. If you have that option and have the means to do it, then that's great. You know, I went through all three schooling options when I was going to school. So, you know, I guess I'm a result of a conglomerate of those things. And frankly, the things that we know about genetics too tell us that, you know, oftentimes, no matter how you school your children, they're gonna end up fine. You know, if they have you as parents, they're gonna do fine. But And there are some kids that I know in public school. Frankly, public school is a great red pilling experience for a lot of kids. And, you know, depending on where you are, another one of the reasons why we had to pull her out of public school was because in Seattle, she was going to kindergarten, and my cat wants to say hi. So I'm a kid mom and a cat mom. One of the things that they were doing is, you know, we would have conversations of, well, who's biting you on the playground? Well, it's the Black kids. Who is stealing your necklaces and, you know, taking your stuff and destroying it? Well, it's the Black kids. She had to sit across from a Somali kid who threatened to cut her hair every day. And she was a victim of this kind of social engineering that they try to do, where they take the good kids and they try to sit them next to the kids that are misbehaving or have problems, like this Somali kid. And, you know, one of the things the Somali kid told her was, if you say Christmas around me, I'm going to freak out. You know, and then at her school, they had to start serving halal meat. And if you know anything about the way that's prepared, it's just absolutely barbaric. So, you know, a lot of the older kids that I talked to who had gone through the public school system, it's definitely a red pilling experience, and they are going to be race realists. But it's also a balance between, you know, we could afford to take the chance to take her out of public school, because, you know, it hurts you as a parent to see your kids go through that kind of situation. But if you're in a good public school in a white neighborhood, then it can be good. And when they get exposed to certain things, yes, definitely, you know, it's better to analyze it with your children than to hide them from it.
I think that's very, very good. That's very thorough. I want to get to a couple more questions here. So I want to go to a question from Blarney Schlubel. What is your thought about finer ethnic balkanization in Europe in tandem with stronger international compliance agreement? Well, I don't know if you like this or dislike it. I guess this phenomenon could be good either way. It could be good or bad, depending on how you understand it. My view is that there are some European countries that might benefit from partition. I know Belgium has a lot of tension between the Flemish speakers and the Wallonians, the French speakers. There might be a benefit for simply having two countries there that could take place. But if a country like Belgium were to be split into two countries, or maybe even three, because there's a German part of Belgium, that wouldn't necessarily be a terrible thing, because both countries would be part of the European Union in all likelihood. They'd pretty much have the same laws, they'd have the same currency, people could travel back and forth, but they would have some sense of control of their own destiny and a sense that their political system will be more aligned with their identity rather than being hitched together with these people that they resent and don't get along with, even though they don't have all that many objective differences. Their languages and their histories are different enough that they don't get along. A similar thing could be said before the UK left the EU, right? If Scotland were to break away from the UK, they would have still been members of the European Union. They might have had the same queen. They might have kept the same currency even. I don't know. But they would have had more independence and a greater sense of controlling their own destiny. I don't think that's such a bad thing. It's having overarching institutions that can sometimes facilitate ethnic separation. It takes some of the sting out of that. So, I mean, that's definitely a possibility. As pan-European nationalists, what we would like is for Europeans to have their own nations to the extent they think that's necessary, and also be able to cooperate internationally with one another rather than, say, go to war with one another or plot against one another. They could be militarily allied with one another, things like that. It's possible to be an ethno-nationalist and have a broad sense of European identity and cooperation and want to have things like treaty organizations between European countries for mutual defense or customs unions to make it easier for people to have commercial relationships and things like that. So I think that's a real possibility. I want to just make sure we're not losing out on any other questions here. Dylan Folk writes in, all jokes aside, can you tell me what was the deal with Don Black's son? What happened and what do you all believe was really going on there? He gives $3. I don't know really, but my speculation, I wrote a piece called The Psychology of Apostasy, speculating on this, that he basically grew up in a context where he just sort of had white nationalism all around him. And he was conforming to that milieu. His father was Don Black. His godfather was David Duke. His mom was David Duke's ex-wife or something like that. It was a very close group of people. And he went off to college and was in a different peer group and started assimilating the new peer group's ideas. That was my speculation. I also kind of I encountered him a few times in the early 2000s at various conferences when he was quite young. And he gave off a kind of vacant stoner vibe, frankly. And I think he might have been or might be some kind of like stoner, which, you know, people like that are very psychologically malleable and weak. And I think he could have just fallen in with a different crowd when he went to college and just conformed to a new crowd. And I read that book that was written about him by this Jewish libtard guy. And I just sort of got the impression that that was a correct hypothesis, that he was just sort of a chameleon, more motivated by social things than facts, and he had come across a new peer group. There was stuff in there saying, oh, his girlfriend, now wife, I think, maybe girlfriend still, I don't know. They're very modern, I bet. She supposedly converted him with the equivalent of like BuzzFeed articles. That just struck me as bogus, right? So anyway, yeah, that's my thoughts on that. Nation of Immigrants writes in with $3. Thank you. Having known Spencer somewhat personally, I can tell you he's a very genuine guy. I don't agree with his new positions, but he's just sincerely a contrarian. And if anything, he's too honest. Okay, well, you might know him better than I do. That's not my impression of him.
I mean, there's a lot of people who are like sincerely retarded.
Well, I mean, and to say sincerely contrarian is to say, well, being a contrarian is sort of different from being sincere, right?
Right.
You're motivated not from the facts, but by basically
the cocktail circuit
out of people. Yeah. It's a form of toxicity. Right. Anyway, it's a form of the struggle for power and recognition. Ron, if you're still listening, thank you for your $600. That's extremely generous. I really appreciate it. So yeah, this is wonderful. Anyway, very, very generous donation. So we're at nearly $700, folks, which is great. This has been a very successful live stream, a very good shot in the arm. We're almost a third of the way to our goal now. And it's a great birthday party. I've really, really enjoyed this. And I want to thank everybody for coming along. So let's just wrap up briefly and let everybody, you know, say goodbye and tell the listeners how they can follow your work. So let's go to Vico first, because you've been quiet for a while. Vico, tell us about how we can follow your work. You publish at Countercurrents. You also have a platform of your own too.
Yes, I do. You can follow me at transcendental-titans.net. That has all my most recent articles on there. So that's the best place to follow me, really.
That's great. That's great. I wasn't sure where you were from or what time zone you're in, but now I know. I can hear it in your accent.
I've been given away. Yes, it's true.
Yeah, yeah. We've had a very Anglophile show tonight, which is great. But anyway, I really appreciate you coming on. Thank you so much.
And thanks for having me, Greg. I do look forward to talking to you more in the future, I hope.
Yeah, yeah. We should have a longer stream together. And I do look forward to the next thing you send in. Rich, so tell us how to follow you. You have many platforms and many initiatives.
Really, the best place is probably, you know, I always tell people just look at my author profile on Countercurrents or on Twitter at @HeyWildRich. Those are probably the best places. And yeah, happy birthday. Thanks for having me on. 12 years online is quite an accomplishment, and hope it grows even more.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like I said, I'm going to be doing this until they carry me out on a stretcher someday. So I look forward to many, many such parties in the future. And I hope all of you guys will be at very least listening, and many of you also on the streams, too. So thank you. Gadius. So thank you again for everything you do. And how do people follow you? You have your own channel on Telegram. Can you give that out?
Yeah, the best thing people can do is to go to Countercurrents and contribute monthly. Make a monthly donation. You know, it could just be small. We got to build institutions, because you think of the ADL, and it got the catalyst for that was Leo Frank. You know, he,
They literally founded the ADL to defend a pedophile murderer.
And if 2020 and the, you know, following years, 2021 and this current year, isn't a catalyst for us to build an institution, you know, comparable to the ADL, I don't know what will be. So, you know, a policy institute, something like that. That's the best thing anybody listening to this can do, is to go to Countercurrents and, you know, drop a few coins in the cup each month.
Thank you so much. I very much appreciate that. We've just instituted some new giving circles. And of course, you can customize your amount if you want to give $12 a month to join our little, in honor of the anniversary, you can do that. Anything is appreciated. And, you know, if the 750,000 visits we had this month, you know, if they all dropped $1 in the kitty, we could call our fundraiser to a rapid conclusion. You know, we have 750,000 visits at the website in the last month.
If I could plug one thing though, there's this killer blog out there. It's subscribestar.com/rich711. You'll find some pretty cozy stuff there.
Okay, yeah, that's Rich's Subscribestar. That's excellent. And you do Building a Third Force on Telegram. And I recommend people go there too.
All righty, happy birthday.
Thank you so much. So Carl, how do people follow you? Have you sneaked back on Twitter? Do you dare blow your cover?
I have. I've been on Twitter, and I've actually, it's funny, like the first few weeks that I was back on there, it was just a terrible, like, for my mental health. And since then, I've kind of like relearned how to deal with it and how to like, you know, kind of keep it to a minimum. So I don't really use Twitter too much. I try to avoid it now, but I'm on Telegram, and that's what I really like, because Telegram is one of those evil echo chambers they tell us about. Anyway, but yeah, you can follow me on Telegram. I'm on as Bitcoin Barbecue, Bitcoin BBQ. I've got a few articles on Countercurrents. I do want to write more. In fact, I was thinking too, I might even one of these days I might get back into drawing and try my hand at like a comic or something. That'd be a lot of fun. I enjoyed being on here with you guys, and you know, I love talking to you and Gadius and Rich and Cyan. You're all very good friends, and I appreciate it very much, Greg.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you very much. So Cyan, everyone knows where to follow you because we're joined at the hip. You are part of the Countercurrents team. I thank you so much. You've not only been out front, in this stream, but you've been helping behind the scenes, helping me keep track of the tallies and not miss super chats and things like that. So this is how we win. We have good people in all positions, and we create, you know, a well-oiled nationalist machine. And that's what Countercurrents has been becoming just in the last 6 months. It's been just dramatic how much better it all functions. And you know, sometimes you don't notice that when you're looking on the surface, but when you interact with our institution, when you need things done, I think you're going to find that things get done a lot more quickly now. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you. And for the whole total, we're at $96,639.63 toward our $300,000 goal. So this is huge progress. So happy birthday to Countercurrents. This is great. Gadius Maximus, by the way, before he opted off, he walks the talk. He is one of our consistent people. I don't know how much I can say, but I just want to say thank you so much. He really, when he encourages you to donate, he's walking the talk.
He does a monthly donation to us, mm-hmm. and he's throwing in super chats all the time on top of that. He's super generous. We really, really appreciate it.
That's right. And thanks. Thank you, Vico. Thank you, Rich, before he hopped off, to everybody else who's been on the stream. I would like to have Rich more often writing on Countercurrents, but you know, that can only happen with your donations. So thank you, everybody who's been contributing. And Carl Thornburn, too, is just such an honor to be on with you. Your Telegram channel is hilarious. Everyone subscribe. It's my favorite. And thank it has you. Really useful information, too.
Good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, everybody out there in Radioland, thank you very much. I am exhausted. This has been 4 hours of fun, but there could be too much of a good thing, and I need to take a break. But thank you. Thank you so much for making 12 years of Countercurrents possible. And here's to 12 more. Okay. We will be back next week with another episode of Countercurrents Radio. And tomorrow, please tune in at the same channel, not the same time, but the same channel for the Writer's Block. The Writer's Block starts at 1 o'clock Pacific time, 4 o'clock Eastern time, 10 o'clock Central European time. Our host, Nick Gilvey, will have a frequent commentator from Countercurrents who goes by Muhammad Aryan to talk about his take on Islam. He mixes it up in a very civil way. With a lot of our guys at Countercurrents on Islam, and Nick is going to have him on to talk more. So this is another example of the normie listener, the great audience that we have out there. Again, everyone's above average who listens to Countercurrents, but it's people who were, you know, reading, and then they started commenting, and now he's taking a step into podcasting. So I'm looking forward to that tomorrow, and a week from today, we will be back with another episode of Countercurrents Radio.